those searchlights up on the towers right now. Move, move.
I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.
Hello, I'm Herb and welcome to Community Spotlight. Each week I try and bring in somebody from our community, an organisation or an event, and talk about the journey. And today I've invited Warren Yeomans back into the studio. Hello, Warren.
Good morning, Herb. Good to be here.
Thank you very much for coming in. This is a follow-up from a previous conversation we had, and this one's called After the Snow, but we'll get to that a little bit later. Just to let people know, you're an orchardist out at Arding on Hawthorne Drive.
That's right, yep. I grew up on the property and been a family business, yeah, dating back to the last century and before.
1865,
yes.
Kilchin.
That's what they, I believe it was called back then, and then became Green Hill in the 1920s.
And Kilchin first cherry.
Yeah, but they certainly planted a cherry tree first in the 1865, so fruit growing has been linked to the property from the very first day.
If I remember correctly, your first ancestor worked for the White family at one of the big properties.
At Somers Homestead. I think most family farms are linked back to the Somers Homestead. They sort of developed some income and then were able to save some money to buy or get access to owning land.
Nice. Now, the fruit that you grow at the moment, apples?
Apples is our main crop, but we also have a good volume of cherries. We also grow pears, nashies, and a range of stone fruits like peaches, nectarines, apricots and plums.
So yes, the cherries are great for Christmas, and you do some juicing, and I think you're doing a new juice this year.
Yeah, this year we tried out apple and ginger, which has been proving to be quite popular, but juicing is mostly with apples and pears and a combination of apple and pear, and so we're always looking for a different flavour or taste, but it's the flavours we have reflect the flavours of the fruit that we grow as well.
I think that apple and ginger might be a bit of a tonic, because I was drinking apple, ginger and lemon as a bit of a tonic.
Yeah. Now, there's a few combinations out there, but certainly apple and ginger as a health item or kick, if you want to put it that way. Yeah, people really like that, and people like the flavour of ginger. It's probably more of an older age group. There's not many kids like the ginger component, but certainly for older people, it's something they really enjoy.
Keep those lurgies away in winter. Fantastic. So you're one of the last orchardists left in our region.
Yes, it's the industry's probably ebbed and flowed, but certainly through the 1960s, 1970s, it was a reasonable sized industry. I'm not sure in the years before that, but certainly there's been fruit growing for quite a while. But since the 80s, it's been in decline. There's lots of business, like farm business, where it's either got bigger or smaller, and so I categorise myself more as a niche operator, and sometimes I call myself an oversized hobby farm, but the last of the commercial orchards in this district.
So up as far as Stanthorpe would be the closest one?
Yes, Stanthorpe is nearest, then Orange going south, so yeah, we're a fair way from either of those two places.
But you supply our local area down to Tamworth and over to the coast with all the fruit?
Yeah, well, that's where I see my niche, as I call it, growing fruit for the local market. If everybody in Armidale alone ate one piece of fruit a day, they'd eat all my fruit within 6 to 9 months. So quite an opportunity there to just support or supply into the local market.
Yeah, but you've got a good cold store as well.
Yeah, we've got cold storage facilities and we can store long-term as well, so... Yeah, we have not the highest high-tech equipment, but we certainly have the technology there to enable us to supply or store fruit for extended time.
On 20 hectares, is that correct?
The property itself is 142, but the orchard area is about 10 hectares, which is a bit over 20 acres.
20 acres. So where are we up to now? We're going to talk about after the snow soon, but where are we up to now in the orchard apart from the repair and restoration from the snowfall?
As far as the cycle of the season goes, we're just coming out of the winter dormancy, and so entering spring blooms. A number of peaches and that have flowered, But we're just entering now with cherries just starting to break bud, and pears are just starting to bloom as well, and apples will be in a couple of weeks.
So I suppose there's one fortunate thing I just thought is if the snow had fell when the blossoms were coming out, it would have been quite critical for the trees.
Yes, it is, and it can happen, but that would be pretty rare. I do remember about 15 or 20 years ago we had snow in November, and that was interesting at the time, but it was not ideal for a late spring growing. But at this time of year, sunny days, and so the bees can do their thing. Yes, yeah, they don't work well in cold weather.
Just a point on bees then. Do you actually have apiarists come in and put bees?
We haven't done that, but certainly the opportunity is there to do that. But we do have a fair bit of native bushland around us, and just by observation, yeah, there's quite a population of bees working. But we're always mindful of that, because with the varroa mite becoming an issue, it hasn't got into this area, and we hope it doesn't, but I can't say never on that one. But I do keep a close eye on the bee population working in the orchard.
All right, nice. Now, for those people listening who'd like to know about the whole cycle of the seasons in the orchard, you can go to 2arm.net.au/podcast, and in the search function just type in Warren Yeomans or Greenhill Orchards, and it'll come up, and you'll be able to listen to our previous interview where we went through each part of the season and the cycle of the orchard. We might just move now, Warren, to the snowstorm that occurred just recently. What was that date?
I think it was the 2nd of August.
2nd of August snowstorm, and it's one of the biggest ones that we've had around, similar to the one 40 years ago.
1984 was a significant snow year, but a very different weather event to this one. 84 was, that we had 2 days of snow, but we didn't have the volume that we had this time. And plus it was very windy, so that blew the snow out of the trees and sifted things, whereas this snow event was very calm, very heavy and consistent.
So allowed the snow to settle, and in combination you had very wet conditions underfoot, very soggy conditions. And I had an interview with Pete Metcalf, and he talked about his wattle trees, how a lot of them just fell over because it was so wet. But we'll get to that. The hail netting that you've got.
Yep.
You've got about 6 hectares of hail netting.
Yes.
What does the hail netting do?
The step before that is that the amount of hail that we are exposed to potentially. Historically, hail is a frequent occurrence on the tablelands and further north and east of us. And fruit growing is an annual crop, so you only get one chance each year of producing a crop. And hail can come in various volumes. I generally say that we've got a 99% chance of hail, it's just a matter of how much. So probably in about 20% of years it could be quite devastating, so it's in declining amounts in other years. So some years, a little bit of hail, it would never bother us. But primarily overall, hail protection became a more and more important thing, because the more fruit that you lose to various things, the profit margin disappears fairly quick. So by protecting the fruit from any particular potential damage, like hail, it became more economically important. Creating a barrier between the tree and the atmosphere was the way to go. So that's what we've ventured into. To be viable, though, you've really got to have productivity so it becomes more intensive. Fruit production per hectare becomes more viable.
But the hail netting also provides a microclimate. So not only does it stop the hail and damaging the fruit from hail, but it also creates a microclimate where evaporation is reduced.
Yeah, no, it's proven to have other benefits beyond the protection from hail. So, less evaporation, so water conservation, there's a lesser demand on irrigation needs. Wind run is reduced, and the intensity of sunlight, on hot days, for instance, and even the extremes of cold, spring frost or late spring frost, and that it's mitigated to some degree the severity of that. So it modifies the atmosphere somewhat in that environment.
So, and also exclusion of the birds from raiding the fruit.
Yeah, so we've included bird exclusion on the perimeter of the structure, and so the ingress of birds, particularly when it comes near a harvest, that stops that, and which is becoming more and more important. We're finding the birds annually are becoming a bigger problem as well.
And it I suppose also it reduces the need to use scare guns and electronic devices to to move the birds on, which is all good and for the birds.
Yeah, it's good for the birds and for ourselves as well because of noise impact, but also time consumed.
So it serves as a multi-purpose thing as far as from what you've told me.
Yes, yes.
Not just the hail. Yeah. And that's probably one of the problems with our consumer society. We want a grade of product that is very high, a grade one product.
Yes, yeah, we like everything to look nice. So, yeah, having a fruit that is appealing to the eye, our senses already aroused to the flavours that potentially are there, but something that doesn't look pretty, we're less inclined to want to eat it. So we are a bit driven that way, but so the market drives what we try and do to present a product that's good for everybody.
Yeah, so it's not only the blemishes that are on fruit, and it's also the shape, which I was surprised. You've got to have almost a perfect shape apple to sell it as a grade one.
Yes, even with all the protection, there's a lot of effort goes in. Pest and disease management, nutrition and all those things that do contribute to the appearance of fruit. Yeah, so it's a bit of a challenge on all fronts.
I think there is an old song, leave me the spots on my apples, I want the birds and the bees. But anyway, that's our consumer society. The hail netting went in about 25 years ago, the first portion.
Yeah, our first venture into hail netting was about 25 years ago, and we've added to that over the years, try and protect more of our area.
Let's just walk through the snow as it unfolded. The snow started falling about 9:30, I think you tell me, on the 2nd of August. You were out in the field.
Yeah, well, I'd taken interest in the weather, and there was a lot of reporting on the radio about snow and gyre, and people were sort of getting a bit excited about that, and so I was certainly watching the weather, and then sort of you see a few snowflakes around the 9 o'clock mark. And usually the way things have been over the last several years, so if you see snow, you get your camera out and take a snap of it because it mightn't last. And but certainly by 9:30 it was starting to snow and just continued to increase as the morning progressed.
So by about 11 o'clock you knew that something was not well.
Well, it was settling quite well, and so actually we'd had about 15 millimetres of rain leading up to the beginning of the snow, so the ground was quite wet, so to see snow settling on top of wet ground was probably a bit remarkable in itself. But the intensity of the snow just meant that it was just piling up fairly quick, which then aroused my concern about how the nets were coping. We've had snow on the hail nets before. It's usually stopped within quite a safe margin, but when I was walking around, I could start to see that things weren't going to go so well on this occasion unless things stopped fairly quickly.
So what was the first things you noticed? Was it the anchorage giving way or the nets giving way? What was sort of happening?
Well, where I was standing on so I was under the newer netted block, I could see poles starting to lean in, which meant the anchors were giving up. It was a disaster in slow motion, so it just happened slowly, and then we realised that we should be standing on the outside, not the inside, and things like that. But it just happened gradually. You could just see it all gradually coming undone.
So yeah, as you said, with the wet ground underneath, that those poles. And how tall are those poles?
They're about 6 metres at the peak. Yeah.
6 metres, and they're strung with cables across to the other ones, and then cabling down to the ground as an anchor point?
Yeah, there's some heavy duty sort of cabling and high tensile wire and combination of different things, but so it's only as strong as the weakest link.
You've been able to salvage, or you will be able to salvage, some of the elements of the hail netting. What are they, the ones you're going to be able to salvage? Are they the poles and the cables and the guides?
Yeah, primarily the wooden poles, the cables, all the metal parts are all salvageable, but the net itself, because it imploded over the trees sort of penetrated the net, and there's just far too many holes, there was a lot of tear points as well, so the amount of potential stitching is just enormous, so it's not even worth contemplating.
If you had to actually replace all the hail netting, this is poles, cables and netting, we're talking about $500,000, aren't we?
That's right. Yeah, to start from scratch, it's a pretty big investment. Yeah.
Well, luckily we don't have to start from scratch.
Yes.
You've now assessed what's going on and you're able to keep the poles and cabling, but it's the netting that has to be replaced.
Because this is uncharted territory for us. The initial thing was, well, we've got to walk backwards before we can go forward. So we've sort of got to undo the structure. So we had to remove the net off the trees, and then we're trying to jack the poles back up where we can to get the cables up off the trees so that we can actually drive up and down the rows. And it's taken us several weeks just to do that. Well, on two orchards, there's one orchard still to go. And then we can sort of assess the damage to poles, and two main blocks are fairly free of pole damage, but we're able to salvage most of the poles, and we've got to redo a lot of anchors because they pull straight out of the ground.
Do you have the machinery on site to be able to do this work?
The anchorage part, we'd have to bring in machinery to do that, but we have a lot of equipment to do our own net tensioning and cable work and that. There is a certain amount of specialist work that we'd have to get some experts in for, but we've had a bit of experience, and we do have a bit of equipment to do a lot of work ourselves.
Well, that's very fortunate. Did you have any specialists come in straight after the snow to give you some advice?
Yes, we've had a number of helpers, advisors, and good advice from various people, but particularly from our suppliers, who have probably 40 years of experience in the industry. So with their expertise, and also they're looking, they're shaking their head as well, so they're seeing things that they haven't seen before as well. So this was quite a catastrophic event.
So the trees, tell me about the trees. What did the damage to the trees?
Depending on where the trees were lined up, so some trees escaped damage, but there's a lot of trees, we had bent limbs, broken limbs. Because it was wet, they went out of line as well, so they're sort of leaning in the wrong direction, and main limbs broken, and in some trees probably even broken off in half. Or even with the younger trees, they just got flattened to the ground, and it turns out, and closer inspection, they sort of cracked down to the trunk, so we're sort of cutting them off, and it's as if we just started planting a new orchard.
Is that to say then that the trees are salvageable, but it'll just take a number of seasons to salvage the damage for the trees?
Yes, it is. Particularly the younger ones, it'll be sort of a setback of 2 years or more. And with the older trees, it'll be just renewal of broken branches to fill up that space on the tree again.
So this current season that's coming up is going to be the most impacted. I think you told me that about 50% of apple production will be reduced.
Yeah, I can see that about a reduction of about 50% of the crop reduction, and stone fruit probably about, particularly with cherries, maybe about 20% reduction.
So fewer cherries for Christmas.
Yes, but anyway, we can only work with what we've got.
So. Exactly. So that then takes me to the GoFund page. Now, your daughter-in-law, Genevieve, has put together a GoFundMe page, and that is to try and help get that netting up and all in operations again.
Yes, it wasn't our own initiative initially, because a number of people said that they were willing to set up a GoFundMe for us, and wasn't something that had obviously, we haven't been in that place before, but anyway, we thought, if people are offering to support us, we'll provide the opportunity to do that. So yes, we're extremely appreciative of the support the community has given us, and the GoFundMe has been well frequented.
Well, I just had a look at it then before I came on air, and it's actually going really well. It's fun. It's interesting. I had a look at some of the names that have contributed, and I know a few of them, so maybe I should get on board as well, so I don't feel left out. If you want to support this effort from Warren and his family to get the Greenhill Orchards up and running again, particularly with the hail netting for future years, and as you heard, that the trees are probably going to take a few seasons to get going, but we need to put that hail netting back across, not only for the hail protection but also for the microclimate, and to produce the really good quality fruit that Warren and his family produces. You go to the GoFundMe web page and you'll find under the search engine Greenhill Orchards Snowfall Recovery, and you can make your contribution, and it'll be greatly appreciated. But also, if you want to find out updates on what's going on at the orchard at any time, there's a Facebook page, Greenhill Orchards, and I think Genevieve runs the Facebook page as well.
She would contribute, but it's mostly done by my wife, Bronwyn, and Tom also is involved in that. And we endeavour to keep people updated in the seasonal progress, but now we're more intentional updating on hail net progress, and so that people can see that happening week by week, and there's photos to show people what's going on and what's happening in the life of the orchard as well.
You've got a positive attitude, Warren.
Thank you.
You've always had a positive attitude. You probably, that's part and parcel about being an orchardist, I suppose. Roll with the punches. This punch has been fairly major, but it sounds like you are going to get back on track. Might take a couple of seasons for the fruit, and we might have this year a little bit less cherries, but if the GoFundMe page is any indication, I think you'll get a lot of support from your community, or continue to get a lot of support from your community to get the hail net up and running and create that microclimate, produce those grade one apples and fruit that we all require. Because Green Hill Orchards and all the work you do for growing fruit, you're a gem in our community, Warren.
Oh, thank
you. I said that before, and I do believe it. Growing fruit, and I wish you all the best and with your endeavours to get back on track.
Oh, thank you. It's been an enjoyable effort to participate in this and just let people know what's going on.
And that's Community Spotlight. Thanks, Warren.
Thank you.
Broadcast, then podcast. If you missed it or want to hear it again, then visit our webpage, 2arm.net.au/podcast. I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.